Hello, I'm Harry Glorikian, and this is Moneyball Medicine, the show where we meet executives, entrepreneurs, physicians, and scientists using the power of data to reinvent healthcare. From machine learning to genomics to personalized medicine, we look at the biggest trends in patient care and healthcare management. And we talk to people behind the trends to find out where data is making the biggest difference. In the last episode, I had a great time catching up with Andrew Radin, the CEO of Tuzar. And during our conversation, he said something that got me super excited. He told me the story of how one of his most experienced advisors approached him to join the company. I immediately said, I need to have him on the show. Why, you might ask? Well, I hope that answer becomes apparent as you hear the story of his arc of discovery. In today's episode, I chat with Tuzar's Senior Vice President of R&D, Dr. Mark Eller. He is a veteran drug developer with 30 years experience in pharma R&D. His knowledge regarding the pharma drug development industry is extremely deep. Now you all know that Tuzar is an artificial intelligence-driven drug discovery company. They leverage their computational platform to look for promising drug candidates, validate and de-risk them through preclinical studies, and progress the promising candidates to the clinic through industry and investor partnerships. But Mark, who is VP of R&D, isn't a data guy, like many of the rest of the crew. As a matter of fact, he was extremely skeptical of the whole approach when he started as an advisor. Ironically, Mark is no different to many of the people I speak to on this topic all the time. This is why I'm so excited to have this conversation. In this episode, Mark will take us on his journey from skeptic to true believer. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for asking me on.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you here. And I honestly, I'm really excited about this conversation after Andrew mentioned, like, you know, he sort of gave me a sneak peek of the story, and I was like, oh my God, we got to do the show, like we got to have this conversation. And so, Mark, just for, you know, everybody that's, you know, that's listening, sort of, can you give us a little bit of your background? Because you're not the, you know, computer science born and bred person, right? That a lot of the people that I will have on the show, you're hardcore drug discovery.
I had one programming course in college that I actually took to fulfill a foreign language requirement because, you know, programming languages were the neat new thing and they wanted to encourage that. So, yeah, I have no sort of technical knowledge in programming, and my background, my training is in clinical pharmacology, and basically spent, you know, the last 30 years in the drug industry in big pharma and CROs on non-clinical, preclinical development and clinical pharmacology, PKPD. And, you know, before I started Tuzar, I was consulting for a while. And before that, I was at Jazz for 12 years, starting out as VP of research, and then had various titles along the way. And along the way, I became inventor on something like 30 patents, including the ones, the original ones for the antihistamine Allegra, and then at Jazz on some of their Xyrem patents. And just had, you know, spent my time in developing drugs. That was my passion and what I like to do, especially the early stages of drug development. And then started consulting after I left Jazz, and Tuzar was one of my first clients. So that's how I got to them.
So essentially, you know, what I would consider, you know, a traditional drug development background. Well, I mean, obviously distinguished, like you've done some incredible stuff, because my son takes Allegra, so I'm sure he's very happy that you developed it. But I guess your first exposure to this was dealing with Tuzar as a client, if I understand correctly.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, they were mostly computer and bioinformatics people. They had a few people with drug development background, but they realized they needed more in that area. And through a friend of a friend, they reached out to me, and I was consulting. And so I just said, sure, I'll be happy to help them. And, you know, what I knew about AI at that time was like from documentaries I had seen about, you know, computers beating chess. And then there was the more recent one about AlphaGo and about the Go Masters and, you know, the team from that, you know, Google bought them, and they've got they're playing the master, and the computer program wins, and they're oohing and aahing about this, and they can't figure out why the computer, you know, made this winning move or why it came up from that. And, you know, that was my understanding of AI. And I couldn't understand how AI could possibly help with drug development, because I could see, okay, for a game, I can see how a computer could play against itself over and over again and figure out what, you know, what are the winning moves and learn to think ahead and things like that. But for drug development, you know, if you use that game analogy, and if you use like success as an FDA approval, then there's only a few thousand games that have ever been played. And so how is a computer supposed to iterate on that? And if you, if you define an approved drug as a win, as the target that you're going after, then how are you ever going to come up with a better drug or a drug for a disease where there aren't drugs approved, which is the goal. So I didn't understand how AI could help with that. But as I became consulting with them, you know, they obviously didn't bring me in for the AI part. They brought me in to say, okay, we found this interesting molecule, and we have these, how should we test it? Or we've tested it and now we have these results. Help us interpret that, or help us with the next step. And, you know, I would do that, and I would say, oh, you know, this looks pretty good. This is neat. I want to thought that that might happen, but obviously it did. And in sort of retrospect, they can figure it out. Okay, so now we should do this, you know. And I would see that, you know, that pattern would repeat itself, where they would, you know, they would run their computer platform and come up with like 9 or 10 molecules and put them in a non-clinical model of efficacy, and 2 or 3 of them would pop out positive. And the hook for me was they all had new mechanisms of action. So these were mechanisms of action that hadn't been tested in the patient population for that disease. And so, you know, that was an immediate challenge to my understanding of AI. So how did a computer come up with that? And I didn't know the answer to that question, but, you know, the more and more I saw results like this, the more and more I thought, however it's doing it, it's producing results that are interesting, and, you know, at a sort of a higher success rate than a lot of traditional methods of drug discovery. And that was something that was very appealing to me, and I wanted to be a part of. So I started talking to Andrew then, and sort of ended up as Senior Vice President of R&D here.
So what, you know, walk me through sort of, you know, that from skepticism to I want to be part of this. It's, you know, what you did, you said, look, it was showing you pathways.
It was the results and the pathway, but also my understanding of AI sort of changed. So, you know, I joined in November of last year, 2019, and in September of 2019, I was reading this article by Bob Temple, who was this senior person at the FDA, and he's been around for a long time. He was involved with the approval of Allegra, and he was talking about how there was this new age in drug development. He called it the age of individualization, or like personalized medicine, right? So recognizing that individual differences in patients contribute to individual variations in response. And there, you know, the he called the previous ages the ages of safety and efficacy, and he was citing regulation. And he said, but for this age, it wasn't really kicked off by regulation. It was kicked off by the discovery of drug interactions with Selding. And I was involved in doing those drug interaction studies, and it was actually those studies that led to the invention of Allegra, which didn't have the problems that led Selding to be withdrawn from the market. But it struck me that what was happening then was like the very beginning of the introduction of signal detection into the pharmaceutical industry. You know, Selding on average was very safe, so safe that the company wanted to go OTC. And that's what I was hired in to do, to help them repeat some studies and get it ready for OTC. But then we started getting these reports of drug interactions and arrhythmias. And it was the first sort of application of signal detection in the pharmaceutical industry. Signal detection, signals from individual patients. So looking at individual patients for signals. And at first, you know, the signal detection system was so crude that the only signal that broke through were arrhythmias. And then we learned how to parse a piece of the ECG, the QT interval, as a signal detection system. And, you know, as a result of those drug interactions, FDA also introduced MedWatch, which is a signal detection system to get adverse event data from marketed drugs. And then, you know, that's one of the things FDA, you know, monitors how the drugs are actually working in the marketplace and are there any unexpected reactions and things like that. And it sort of hit me then that what Tuzar was doing and how they were using AI was actually as a signal detection system, sifting through genomics data and phenotypic data and all these different data sets and examining it with an AI system to look for efficacy signals. And with that sort of reframing of, you know, drug discovery as a problem in signal detection, it makes it a problem that's amenable to a computational solution and allows you to apply, you know, methods of signal detection that have been used in other places, other industries, to pharmacology. And, you know, the results that then it sort of clicked and it fit with the results that I was seeing. Oh yeah, you know, the computer wasn't playing a game to come up with this compound. It was sifting through this data, looking for signals. And then, you know, we tested it, and lo and behold, the signal was validated, at least in the first animal model or in vitro test. And so with that sort of reframing of my understanding of AI, along with sort of defining the drug discovery problem, it started to all fit together. And that's when I thought, you know, wow, you know, if signal detection 20 years ago, 25 years ago, according to Bob Temple, was the thing that ushered in this new era in, you know, development or pharmaceutical development. Well, if we apply signal detection to the beginning part, to efficacy, you know, I think it has tremendous potential. And I'm just surprised it hasn't been done before, because it's really kind of, the results are better, let's say, just say much better than I would have anticipated going into this.
Now, so it wasn't just necessarily the results, but I think if I heard you correctly, it's also this factor of time being shorter.
Yes, it's much more efficient. I mean, you know, Tuzar is a very small company, and yet, you know, they've got 18 programs launched, and I think on 10 of them, we have in vitro or animal pharmacology data with positive results. And, you know, it would have taken years and years, especially for a little company like, you know, like this, to generate that data with traditional methods. So it's like much, much more efficient. It gets you out of, you know, the triangle that managers are always talking about, you know, cost and time and quality, and you can get any two of those, but you have to sacrifice on the third one. Well, this just sort of, you know, breaks that all open. You can get really good results very fast and, you know, much more efficiently than the traditional approach. So it was just a big jump all the way around from the traditional way of doing things.
Now, the other thing, though, that you said is, and so I'm trying to use these two axes, right? One is time, one is you were seeing patterns or pathways that you were like, ah, not seen that before. And opening up sort of a unique area to look at that you might be able to develop a new molecule against, which of course is a, you know, always a good place to be.
Yeah, exactly. So that was really the exciting part. So, you know, there's a lot of drug development, and a lot of drugs are like, they're, you know, me too drugs. They're second generation or third generation of something that does this. And maybe there's incremental improvements, you know, and the third statin that's approved is better than the first one or whatever, but they're working by the same mechanism. What was interesting to me is that, you know, Tuzar's approach and their platform would identify molecules that were potentially effective in a given disease, you know, and the approved ones would show up too, or stuff that might be in development by the companies would show up too, which, you know, gives you some comfort that you're on the right track. But what also show up is stuff that not only that hadn't been tested, but that have mechanisms where there's no drug that's approved or even been tested in patients with that disease that have that mechanism. So it's a whole new way of sort of treating the disease. So it's like the computers come up with a new, or the, I shouldn't say the computer, you know, the whole system.
Yes.
People included have come up with a new hypothesis for what might work to treat a given disease that hasn't been tried before. And then, you know, we test those in animal models, and it would, you know, test 10 of them and 3 of them pop up effective. That was very, very exciting.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've talked to a lot of people where they have it, you know, they have a well-understood process of making a molecule, and then they give it to their system and say, you know, is there a faster way, more efficient way? And the system can sometimes tell you how to get to the same end result in a different way than anybody was classically trained. That might bring down cost and decrease time and so forth. And so this doesn't sound, you know, I you can see similarities between all these approaches. Now, the other thing, though, that when I talked to Andrew, he's like, you know, his hypothesis was you could shave off 3 to 4 years of time in the whole process. Like, do you agree with that sort of?
Yeah, I mean, from what we've done so far, from, you know, the things that we've taken furthest along in and have results back from non-clinical pharmacology models, you know, it was like something like 4 months from, you know, saying we want to investigate this disease to having results in a laboratory animals, and, you know, doing them at CROs, the same CROs that Big Pharma uses in sort of standard classical models. And most of that time, frankly, was for the actual conduct of the study, not all the stuff that brought us to that prediction. And the stuff that, you know, in a traditional process that would bring you to that prediction might take years. And here, you know, we had collapsed all those initial steps down into one that just generates efficacy predictions that can be, you know, immediately tested. So yeah, there's that sort of time and efficiency aspect of it. And then, you know, when there are new molecules or new mechanisms of action, that made it really, really exciting.
So now, I mean, but at some point, the system generates what it suggests. And then a human being, though, has got to look at it and be like, yeah, okay.
So, you know, I can give you like a flow step. And the first step is like all computers. And then the last step is basically, you know, humans deciding what animal model should we use to test this hypothesis. And then the intermediate steps, you know, span the range of more computer and less human to more and more human. So yeah, after the initial, you know, generation of possibilities, which might be, you know, 1,000 come out or something like that, then there is this winnowing process and ranking process. And the first few steps of that are also computer assisted or AI assisted to rank them or eliminate molecules that might be too toxic or for a given indication, things like that. And there's human intervention along the way until, you know, finally the decision as to which of the molecules to put into a non-clinical model is dependent on human insight and not AI.
So, but at some point, that information, now you are working with the people actually building the models, right? So there's,
yes.
I assume that you know, I think of this as a figure eight, right? It just, at some point there's feedback, there's correction, or there's modification of the, and then it just keeps going back and forth and just makes it better.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, it was interesting because I was talking to someone earlier today from a big pharma and saying, you know, one of the companies I was talking to has said they're constantly improving their algorithm. And he says, nah, we don't do that at big pharma. You know, our model is pretty well set and you know, we're, unless we think that there's going to be some huge breakthrough.
I think we're on, I don't know. This is a question for Andrew, but version, I don't know, but I'm sure, pretty sure it's in, you know, hundreds of iterations of the software. Yeah. So there's this constant learning process.
So do you see this actually also affecting cost in development?
Well, I think, you know, cost and timing sort of go hand in hand. What really, the way you achieve the timing is because you're eliminating all these, you know, wet lab rate limiting experiments, and those wet lab rate limiting experiments also cost money. So yeah, there's a big cost savings as well as a time saving.
But yeah, I think about it from a rate limiting, but also I think the number of parameters these algorithms can look at is much more than you know.
Oh yeah,
definitely more than me, right? I mean,
this is how it comes up with new stuff that you and I haven't, or other people haven't thought of. It's, you know, I think for one of the programs, lupus, I think there were like, I talked to Aaron Doherty, who heads up runs the platform, and it was something like 2.5 billion, you know, pieces of data that were going into this that it was sifting through. So yeah, it's more than humans can handle.
So, but, and then I always think about like, oh my God, the papers that have to be coming out of this. I mean, at some point, you know, you got to start to let the world know that there's this other potential pathway that you could use this, you know, or, you know, just to publish this stuff and say, here's a different way to come at these problems and make it more of a widespread. Now, I know, you know, you know, as a startup, you want to be first and own it all. But I think about that just from a science perspective.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I agree. I mean, there is, you know, there's that tension between proprietary and getting the information out. So in terms of results, that's certainly something that we are, you know, publishing. For example, the lupus one, I know that the abstracts have been presented, or, you know, all the meetings are virtual now.
But
that we've presented the data from those studies, and also a couple others like hepatocellular carcinoma. And so the data is starting to come out, and people can, you know, judge for themselves and take a look. But it's very positive.
So now, first, if you were talking to other people like with that have your background, so what, you know, how do you, and I'm sure it's come up I'm sure you've had this conversation with colleagues. It's, what do you say to them, and how do you frame it in a way that they sort of can get their head around it quickly, if right? And what are the skeptical comments that you get? Because I'm sure that you and I get probably the exact same comments.
I think it depends upon, you know, it depends upon what they're looking at. So if they're looking at the results of a particular program, if they're looking at our SLE data, I just say, you know, just look at the data and decide for yourself, and then ask yourself, does it really matter, you know, if I came up with the idea or a computer came up with the idea? So there was this game that I used to play at Jazz when we were doing like opportunity assessment, and we called it doing, you know, a pre-mortem. So we pretend, okay, we bought this asset and we did everything and executed according to plan and it failed. Why did it fail? And if you write down all the reasons it could potentially fail, and you know, the last reason is because a computer came up with the idea, you know, that wouldn't stop us from moving forward with that program, because in the end, you know, the FDA doesn't care if a computer came up with the idea or, you know, whoever. They care about a development plan, about development rationale and your data. So it's very easy to convince people on individual products. I think on, you know, the AI side, people are more skeptical, and they're more like in my position. And I have to say, look at, you know, put away your preconceptions about what AI is. And, you know, if you're like me and you thought it was about computers playing games against humans and they win, you know, well, it's a little bit, you know, maybe that's part of it, but it's a little bit more than that. And if you view it as signal detection, that might help you understand what the potential is. And, you know, for me, that helped. And also seeing the results, you know, repeat over and over, you know, convinced me that was in fact the case. But yeah, we do run into people who are skeptical, say, oh, yep, you know, this data looks really nice, and that piece of data looks really nice, and this program looks good, but, you know, they're not, I guess, convinced that there's a block there, and they can't see that, you know, if it works 3 times or 5 times or 10 times, that it's likely to, you know, keep working. And, you know, we think that there are, you know, 1,000 diseases that it, you know, might be applicable for. There's some probably that it's not, you know, like infectious diseases. It's the platform is not set up to do something like that because you've got a third thing, the organism itself. But for other things, it's, you know, it's very broadly applicable.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we've always talked about it, identifying new targets, completely different pathways that, you know, have a major effect on the disease that nobody ever considered. And then the third is repurposing something that's already out there that might actually have a meaningful effect on this particular disease, but nobody's really using it in that way.
Right. Yeah. You know, sometimes we come up with stuff like that too. You know, well, in our list of things that are predicted to be potentially effective, there might be, you know, a drug that's on the market for something else. So that does happen occasionally.
So if you were coaching somebody and that was working their way through the system, would you tell them to study something? Would you tell them to, I don't know, read a particular book? How would you sort of coach someone along that was your younger you?
I would say, always be guided by science, and, you know, look at the results and look at the hypothesis and connect the dots. And if you connect the dots and it says signal detection AI works, you know, trust that and believe it and put away your preconceptions. You don't have to understand the details of the programming to see the results. And if you can just understand the inputs, and if you can understand the idea that a computer can take 2.5 billion pieces of data and process it, and you can't do that, and comes up with predictions, well, test the predictions. It's sort of empirical. It shouldn't involve, you know, I'm a scientist. It doesn't involve belief or trust or whatever. It's like, here's the input, here's the output. Did the output work? Yes. Here's the input in this experiment. Here's the output. Did it work? Yes. How many times do you need to see that to be convinced? And, you know, you can just sort of be agnostic in your beliefs about AI or computers or traditional approaches. And just, you know, just because you're used to doing something one way and it's worked, although maybe, you know, slow and inefficient, you know, don't be closed to the idea that there might be other ways to do things that get you out of that triangle of cost and time and quality.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that I think about is these systems are, it's not like they're standing still either. They're in a constant state of improvement and evolution, which is just making them better over time. And we are collecting more data sets that the system can ingest and build into the model. So I think it's just, it's moving forward at a very fast pace. I mean, you know, I try to explain the speed at which things are happening to people, and it's very difficult for the human mind to understand doubling. Like, has a, I don't know why we have a hard time getting around exponential growth.
I mean, it's like, you know, science, sometimes things in science move sort of in a linear, predictable pattern. And sometimes it's just, it jumps. Like, you know, the Sylvain drug interactions leading to the MedWatch system and signal detection for safety, that didn't come about through a linear process. That was a jump and a response to a problem, and the solution sort of developed de novo. And this is sort of, I think, a similar situation. It represents sort of a break from the traditional way of doing things. And you know, if you're open to an objective, to looking at results, you should be sort of okay with that. You know, but there, you know, we get comments from, you know, where's your, you know, five KOLs in this disease area who came up with this thing. I said, look, you know, the whole purpose of this, you know, we're a small company, and we've got stuff in that we're developing for SLE. We've got it for oncology indications. We've got some, you know, you can partner with people in various therapeutic areas. We don't have, you know, we hire KOLs as consultants when we need them, but we don't have this, you know, staff of therapeutic disease experts who are, you know, working for 20 years to come up with this molecule. But, you know, to give people credit, there's a lot of companies in the Bay Area that's how they are started. Some professor from Stanford been working on this problem for 20 years, and then they spin it off into a little startup company, and people can, you know, wrap their head around that. Whereas, okay, Andrew and Aaron were working on this computer system, and now we're going to apply it to pharmacology, and we can apply it to oncology, we can apply it to inflammatory diseases, and we can apply it in other areas, and, you know, we've got results, and that's just, it's different.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and the other part is if some new pathway comes up that the system came up with, I mean, I'm hard pressed to find a KOL that really, like, you know, would have gone, we absolutely knew about that, right? It's what I find is they're like, oh, I didn't think about that one. And yeah, now that you're showing me the data, that's sort of, I can see how that might make sense. It just wasn't right in front of them and obvious.
Yeah, it's what I would call retrospective predictability. It's sort of now, I didn't think of it, but now that the computer did, and that you've got positive results, yes, I can see how that might work.
We used to call that Monday morning quarterbacking. Like, oh yeah, he should have done that. Yeah, it would have been a better play. So here's one of my final questions is, you know, what do you tell those people that say, tell me the first drug that ever got approved by AI? Like, you know, how do you manage that? Because I get that all the time. And I'm like, well, if you wait for that, like, Jesus, like it'll be over.
Right. That's the thing. The product development cycles are so long. If you wait for, if your standard for, you know, accepting a new way of doing something is final FDA approval, you know, you're going to be caught way behind the curve. I think you have to evaluate the compounds as they progress every step of the way and say, you know, what are the results at this step? What are the results at that step? And are they moving forward? Are they moving forward with better success or worse success or the same as the traditional process? I think that's where we're at. I mean, that's one answer. The, you know, the other answer would be, you know, define what AI is. So, you know, there's AI is sort of, you know, catch-all
right
thing. And, you know, some people would define AI as anything that's more complicated than you could do on an abacus or something, you know, something like that.
Yeah, I whenever I'm talking about AI, it's a toolkit, right? And depending on what I'm trying to do, I may pull out a different, you know, screwdriver or wrench or whatever, but it's a toolkit of capabilities, processes, approaches that you can take to solve a particular problem.
Right. And people are applying it in other areas of the, you know, drug industry, looking, you know, using AI to develop biomarkers or using AI even for like patient recruitment, things, you know.
Right. Right.
We're just applying it to the first step in drug discovery.
So how do you think, you know, if you were a betting man, since you were at Jazz working sort of on this stuff, you are somewhat of a betting man because you're betting on something, finding something new, is, you know, big pharma, startups, where do you, you know, I'm sort of betting on startups because I think they're much more nimble and quick, but, you know, there are good papers in the space coming out from big pharma. It's just, you know, I always try to figure out where do you think the world is.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly, you can find exceptions to the rule, but I think in general, most of the innovation is at small companies. Whether it's, you know, the small companies with the sort of the traditional ones that I mentioned, you know, some professor someplace had an idea that's being commercialized, and then, you know, if it's successful, maybe they take it, or maybe big pharma buys it. That's why there's all these deals. And if you look at who's buying what, it's big companies buying the assets of little companies that did the original innovation.
But it's interesting though, because I think the buyer set has broadened, right? Whereas normally I would think like it would be, okay, Pfizer, Merck, you know, like you could go down the list, right? Now I think there's, you know, potentially there's Amazon, Microsoft, Google. I mean, I was just talking to someone and they were saying, yeah, we keep talking to Amazon about partnering, but you know, they're just missing data. And if they had data, like all of a sudden they become a competitor as opposed to a partner. So it's an interesting dynamic of new names that are coming onto the forefront.
Yeah, I think my experience, you know, was more with the pharma side, but I don't doubt that at all, that more and more people are getting interested. And maybe the AI component of that is more accessible to people at Amazon and Google than it is to, you know, people in, you know, the top five pharma companies. Maybe they're just more, you know, familiar with how to manipulate large amounts of data.
But it's interesting because I think you have to have both. I mean, at some point it's producing all this data, but then someone needs to look at it and think about, okay, that makes sense, right? Or okay, I can believe that. B, how the hell are we going to test that, right? What's the model and how are we going to, and then what's the rest of the process going forward? And that requires some, you know, I wouldn't want a novice. I'd like somebody who's been through that.
That's why I joined Tuzar to help them with that piece. You know, the program or the platform came up with this, and what was helpful and what sort of distinguishes it is, aside from producing, you know, a answer or, you know, quote unquote answer in terms of a prediction, you could trace back why the computer liked this one or why the computer liked that one. And so that was very helpful to me, and that helps you design the appropriate test model to put the molecules in. But a lot of AI, it doesn't give you the rationale. It's sort of a black box type of prediction, and that's much more difficult to deal with.
So this must also spur a lot of IP generation.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it has the potential to do that. I can't talk about.
Yeah, no. I'm just saying in general, right? That as you're moving down this road and you're identifying things at a speed much faster than others, right? The IP attorneys must be quite busy, or you hope they would be.
That would be a predicted outcome, yes.
Well, Mark, any other thoughts along these lines that you can share with it? The people that are listening to this. I mean, I have physicians listening to this. I have people in the pharmaceutical industry. I have my wife listens to it, right? As a layperson, anything you can share with that group from your experience that you would want them to know?
I would just, have an open mind and make your decisions like a scientist based on results. And if you do that, you're on a good path.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I really appreciate the time. It was great to talk to you and hear this story. As these products go forward, we may come back to you and ask you to be back on the show.
I'd love to come back. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for this episode. If you enjoyed Moneyball Medicine, please head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. It is greatly appreciated. Hope you join us next time. Until then, farewell.